Support for the Capital Weekly podcast is provided by Hillside, a new podcast about the investigation and trial of the Hillside Strangler. Narrated by author and friend of the podcast, Joe Redotta, Hillside revisits 10 murders that shocked Los Angeles in 1978 and 1979, followed by the longest murder trial in U.S. history. Joe interviewed more than 40 people connected to the case: detectives, friends and family of the victims, defense attorneys and prosecutors, journalists, and the presiding judge. It's a riveting story of crime, politics, and personal redemption. Hillside, available now wherever you get your podcasts or at hillsidepodcast.com.
Hello, welcome to a special episode of the Capital Weekly Podcast. Today's episode was recorded live Thursday, March 3rd at California Crime, a conference examining criminal justice policy in California. The topic of today's panel was True Crime, the Statistics, moderated by journalist Sigrid Botham.
California Crime was presented as part of Capital Weekly's California Conference Series. Support for California Crime was provided by KP Public Affairs, the Western States Petroleum Association, Perry Communications, Capital Advocacy, Lucas Public Affairs, Pandora, and the California Professional Firefighters.
Thanks very much, Tim. This is an important conference, particularly the intersection of politics and crime and also media coverage. It's good to see you all. If the panelists would all start their video, I'd like to do a brief introduction and then introduce the panelists, after which they will give a brief summary of their of organizations and highlights of their work. At the end of the panel, as Tim mentioned, we'll have a time for questions from the audience. Fluctuating crime statistics have always been fraught with controversy and are subject to wildly varying interpretations, which are often misleading, frequently misconstrued, and utilized for partisan purposes. Statistics are reported by local jurisdictions, then assembled by state and federal agencies, and data collection may vary. I've covered the criminal justice system as a journalist for decades, as well as many interrelated issues, and was responsible for organizing statewide press conferences on the annual crime stats when I was press secretary to then State Attorney General John K. Vandekamp. I organized similar press conferences on the equally controversial subject of student test scores in my previous role as press secretary to the then State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Wilson Riles. I was struck then by the similarities between these two heavily covered news events and the fact that both are based on statistics gathered by local jurisdictions in school districts and from law enforcement. And as Tim mentioned, I always enjoyed working with statisticians, other expert staff in both agencies, and likely had much better access than when I was a reporter. We always had fascinating, sometimes behind-the-scenes discussions about what those statistics mean, how they are collected and interpreted. Subsequent discussions at this conference today will focus on solutions, suggested changes, and how crime is addressed in California. This panel is intended to set the foundation for those discussions, and we're very honored to have this distinguished and highly knowledgeable group of panelists to help lead us through the thicket of complex statistics, their historical context, and what they mean. There are more detailed biographies of our panelists in your online program on the Capital Weekly website, but I'd like to start by introducing each panelist, then asking them to give us a brief overview of their organizations, highlights of their work. And again, there will be time for questions from the audience toward the end of the panel. Magnus Lofstrom specializes in criminal justice and public safety issues as policy director and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and as a visiting professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy. Focusing on crime rates and recidivism, his recent work examines crime statistics and criminal justice reforms in California and many other related subjects. His research has been widely published. He received his PhD in economics from the University of California, San Diego. Allison Lunetta is a manager in the Investigative Services Program in the Criminal Justice Statistics Center of the California Department of Justice, which collects and reports statistical data used to assess crime and the criminal justice process in California. The center maintains multiple statewide data systems containing specific criminal justice data, which is available through the Attorney General's Open Justice website. Jennifer C. Noble is an assistant professor in the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. She is a former criminal defense attorney who practiced largely in federal court, focusing on white-collar cases such as mortgage fraud, tax evasion and tax fraud, healthcare fraud, and money laundering. She is the author of White Collar and Financial Crimes, a casebook of scam artists, fraudsters, and corporate thieves, published by the UC Press. She is also a journalist and former State Capitol Bureau reporter for the Associated Press. And I remember Jennifer as a standout journalism student and State Hornet reporter at Sacramento State when I first started teaching there in the late 1980s. She holds a BA in Journalism and Government from CSUS and a JD from the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Gregory Totten is the CEO of the California District Attorneys Association, a Sacramento-based professional association which helps train prosecutors and works to influence government policy, offering seminars and providing publications, and as a forum for innovation in the criminal justice field. He is a longtime former prosecutor who was Ventura County District Attorney for nearly two decades, elected to five consecutive terms. His law degree is from Pepperdine Caruso School of Law. Now, if each of you could give us a brief intro with highlights of your work and the issues we'll be discussing here, and then we'll have an open and, I hope, a good exchange of ideas. Allison, would you like to unmute and start the discussion?
I work for the California Department of Justice, which is housed under the Attorney General's Office for California, and I'm the program manager for the Criminal Justice Center. And we are the program that's responsible for all of the statistical reporting under the UCR blanket with the FBI. One of the things that we have been working tirelessly on is making sure that our data is clean and full, meaning we have representation across the state so that when we put our data out for the public and policy and researchers to use on our Open Justice website and in our annual publications, that it's accurate and it's reflective across the state for those users. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. And Magnus, if you could tell us a little bit about your background.
Hey, thanks, Sigrid, and thank you all for being here. And I think it makes sense to kind of kick off these discussions with a high-level overview of crime changes over the last few years and discuss possible contributing factors. And then, so with that in mind, broadly, violent crime is roughly where it was before the pandemic, with a notable exception that homicides jumped by about 30% in 2020. And based on some preliminary data limited to some of the bigger cities in California, it does not appear to have returned to pre-pandemic levels in 2021. And while most property crimes dropped sharply in 2020, it appears to be on the uptick in 2021, returning roughly to pre-pandemic levels. But there is one exception there, and that's auto theft, which rose about 18% in 2020. And that's a trend that does not appear to have reversed in 2021. And California's notable criminal justice reforms like realignment in 2011 and Prop 47 in 2014 have been suggested to have contributed to increases in crime, both at the time of the implementations as well as now. But I think it's important to point out that no research to date has linked any of these reforms to changes in violent crime. But in our research, we did find that they were contributing factors to coinciding increases in some property crime. And more specifically, auto theft went up as a result of realignment and larceny increased in the wake of Prop 47. And now for Prop 47 was primarily driven by a very notable increase in car break-ins. Mm-hmm. And then if we turn specifically to the crime changes over the last 2 years, and then some of the other possible underlying factors, I think one key thing to recognize here is that it is really difficult to disentangle incredibly pin changes on any one factor. COVID presented highly unusual times that upended our lives. We had shelter in place orders and various mandates, and this changed where we work, where we travel. It limited socializing. And with all that, we had fewer interactions with people. And that very likely led to reductions in some crime. And at the same time, we have experienced severe and importantly disparate economic impacts, public health concerns, and efforts to prevent the spread of COVID presented a number of challenges to our criminal justice system, which led to state and local directives and mandate that significantly affected policing, including arrests and bookings. It affected jails, prisons, as well as courts. And then summer of 2020, we had civil unrest in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and heightened concern about racial disparity in policing and criminal justice more broadly. There were increases in gun sales and then as well, possibly in drug uses as well. And these are just some example of possible contributors. But with so many factors and dramatic changes overlapping, I think it's very difficult to credibly attribute any specific one to the recent increases in some crime. And well, I think we should undoubtedly engage in efforts to better understand what is behind the increases in some violent crime. There's no other way to address it, but to kind of have a sense of what's driving it. It's worth pointing out that crime rates in California are really at low levels from a historic perspective. Violent crime is roughly where it was in 2010 before the state embarked on a number of criminal justice reforms, all pretty much aimed at reducing our reliance on incarceration. And property crime in 2020 was at the lowest level since 1960, which is really the beginning of consistent crime stats recording. And then lastly, but importantly, it also appears that the increases in crime that we have experienced here in California are really not unique to our state, but they are part of a broader changes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And Jennifer, if you could unmute.
Hi, good morning. Thanks very much for the invitation to be here today. It's really nice to be on this panel. As Sigrid mentioned, prior to coming to Sacramento State to teach in 2016, I was a defense attorney practicing largely in federal court and mostly focusing on white collar crime. And prior to that, I was a journalist. So my interests in research at the Division of Criminal Justice at Sac State focus on white collar crime, but I'm also very interested in sentencing reforms on the federal level. I'm currently undertaking some research with a colleague that looks at the interactive effect of race, ethnicity, and gender on white-collar sentencing decisions, which we're just starting to tease out. And I really appreciate all the work that these statisticians do on statistics, because this is the third time I've chosen a career on my mistaken assumption that there would be no math involved. That's why I was a journalism major in the first place. So I really appreciate the work you all do to make this information accessible to the rest of us.
You've also done some writing on media coverage of crime, which we will touch on as well during.
I have. That's an area that I'm very interested in, obviously, with my background.
Gregory.
Thank you, Sigrid. I'm delighted to be here with these distinguished panelists and thank Capital Weekly for hosting this event. I've been a prosecutor, if it's hard to believe, and I went to law school in part because math wasn't my best subject, but I've been a prosecutor for nearly 40 years, and in my current role, I'm pleased to be representing California, most of California's elected district attorneys, and about 3,500 prosecutors statewide. At the association, we focus on education. We provide training programs, publications for prosecutors. We also engage regularly in the public policy debate and have a registered lobbyist that appears regularly at committee testifying on our issues. And I will just say The issue of crime statistics is, I think, as Magnus has pointed out so eloquently, it is a complex issue with a myriad of factors influencing it. I will tell you from a prosecutor's perspective and dealing with prosecutors who are regularly working in the courtrooms and seeing what's going on in their community, we do have grave concerns about the impact of many of the so-called criminal justice reform measures and their impact specifically on our ability to timely prosecute cases, to have closure in those cases for our victims, and to incapacitate the most dangerous predators in California from being able to continue to commit crimes. And we think a lot of the reforms, though well-intentioned, have had negative consequences on our ability to perform that function. So we're, as I say, we're delighted to participate in this. We may be an outlier in terms of some of your other commentators, but we're pleased to be here.
Thanks very much. I'd like to start with an overview, and you've already, Allison and Magnus, you've touched on this, of recent California crime statistics reported by the State Department of Justice and their historical context and how those statistics compare to national trends. Since statistics are provided by local jurisdictions, do data collection methods differ among jurisdictions? Are there any statewide standards or national standards, and how accurate, I mean, I know this is a difficult question to answer, how accurate and up to date are the statistics? Allison, can you comment on that?
Absolutely. So the majority of the statistics that are used for crime evaluation fall under the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting format, which all states use to report to the FBI. So each agency within California may have their own policies and procedures for collecting data at the local level based on how their record management system works, how that interacts with their dispatch and their jail management system. So at the local level, there may be a wide range of differences in how that's collected or how it's populated in their own systems. However, when it comes to the state and when it comes to other states as well, and when it goes up to the FBI, it's all standardized. Everybody's using the same definitions. So, for example, Agency A collects an additional set of data. But all of that information that is definitionally defined by the FBI is what is reported to us. So you can make those connections and you can compare that data across states and across the nation and really use the data knowing that everybody's reporting under the same definitions of those crime types. Now, where there may be gaps, we know, is we're reliant on law enforcement to report that data to us. And we do everything in our power to make sure that the data that is reported to us is clean and is whole and meets the definitional standards set in place by the Uniform Crime Reporting Standards. Law enforcement is required on the, is dependent wholly on the public reporting those crimes to them. So there are definitely going to be gaps from what's happening out in the public, which is something, you know, the media may pick up on more things. You know, crime victims aren't always willing to report those crimes, but people hear things that media picks up on those things. So there are gaps in what is happening in our communities versus what law enforcement is getting versus what the state is actually having in the repository to provide out to everybody.
Magnus, do you have anything? Do you have anything to add to that?
I think that's a really good summary of the issue. I do think, especially the issue and the concern about individuals, businesses, organizations reporting crime is something that can vary. You know, depending on what the what the crime climate looks like, but also what is being reported in media. So it's if a particular issue is getting attention in media, it's possible that it's also you're seeing more crimes, that type of crime being reported. But it's also possible that as we're seeing big increases in crime, and especially in maybe in some property crime at times, that individuals feel like this is just so prevalent that they may not report it completely as well. And this issue of reporting is something that is important for us to keep in mind as we're looking at the numbers, keeping in mind that it is we're dealing in some instances with underreporting. That is definitely a concern. But the crime statistics that we are using and that we rely on to a large extent for these kind of discussions, what they appear to do, though, is able to capture swings in crime as well. What the magnitudes are is up to up for debate, but they seem to be able to capture the swings. We saw it. We have seen it recently. If we look at the last couple of years, and larceny, for example, very notable drops in larceny in 2020. But in last year, those same crime stats picked up on the notable increases as well that returned us to the pre-pandemic levels. Mm-hmm. But the levels themselves represent no likelihood in underreporting, but the statistics appear to be able to capture changes in those trends.
And I want everyone to feel free to interject here if you have any follow-up. You know, I want this to be a free exchange of information. Jennifer, the issue of media coverage comes up frequently. You have any thoughts on, you know, if it bleeds, it leads? That's the old.
Yeah. Before I go there, I just want to follow up on something that both Magnus and Allison just mentioned about that underreporting, because in the area that I study, you know, includes fraud, and that is an area where we do see a lack of, you know, victims coming forward. There's a lot of shame associated with being a victim of a financial fraud. And so, like embezzlement cases, a business may not want to admit that the trusted bookkeeper took millions of dollars from them, especially if they're in a position of trust where they're entrusted with client funds. Or you might also see people who are victims of financial scams who are embarrassed that they fell for it, blame themselves. And if they do report it, it might be to their bank, but not necessarily to the police. So there's a large section of crime that we're very much at risk at that's sort of under the surface. We don't really see it. Potentially larger than our risk for, you know, of being a victim of a violent crime. So that is just something I want to mention since we were talking about underreporting of crime statistics. But to talk about the media coverage, I'm really loath to criticize reporters. I'm a former reporter, and I understand how the pressures that are on newsrooms and have been. I got out of reporting in 2006, and it was right before news organizations began putting reporters' emails on every story that went out. My hate mail was literally mailed to me. So I feel very fortunate not to be getting that sort of abuse that comes with reporting now. And also the strain that comes with newsrooms being skeletons of what they used to be. And, you know, I know reporters are being asked to do more with less, which always results in doing less with less. And, you know, I do understand those pressures. So I hate to criticize. I'm going to criticize.
the deep dive reporting, long form reporting, whatever we want to call it, you know, they don't really have the time to do that. You're seeing some improvements in terms of nonprofit journalism like Capital Weekly. There are many others, and that's very hopeful to me. But I read these crime stories, and then I want to say, okay, well, what's going on behind the scenes here? What does this really mean? And talk to the people involved. But Gregory, do you have any thoughts in this area?
I'd like to add on the media, having dealt with the media throughout the majority of my career, I have to say that I would be very reluctant to criticize them because, you know, the typical courthouse reporter is covering numerous stories. They encounter DAs like me and trial prosecutors who are subject to all kinds of ethical restrictions on what we can and cannot say to the media. So getting the information in and of itself is difficult. The pace of the story coverage is critical. They want to break the story as soon as they can. And so sometimes they make mistakes that are understandable and human errors. And I've always had good experiences with media correcting the stories. I think they, as I say, they experience frustration with lawyers on a case, both defense and prosecution, getting the information they want because we have to be so cautious. But I would not criticize the media on the coverage of crime. I do want to just echo some of the things that have been said about underreporting. I think as it relates to theft in particular, and perhaps most specifically to retail theft, we believe very strongly that there's tremendous underreporting of retail theft. I mean, if all of us pay attention to what we see with our eyes on the nightly news, what we see in newspaper and the photos of smash and grabs, the video of people, you know, riding a bicycle into a store and loading up a trash bag and riding unabated out of the store with property. A lot of businesses, and we are told by a former executive from a Fortune 100 retailer that to his best estimate, only about 20 to 25% of retail theft is being reported post Prop 47. And the simple reason for that is from a retailer's perspective, they're deeply concerned about risk management issues. They're deeply concerned about protecting their brands and not scaring the public. But they've got employees they want to keep safe. They've got concerns about possible lawsuits because most of these cases do not result in criminal prosecutions. Again, in part because of the law and the limitations of the law. So from a businessman's, business person's perspective, there's huge risk in reporting, and we believe there's tremendous underreporting of retail theft.
Yeah. If we could focus on that aspect. As Capital Weekly pointed out in the introduction to this panel, while high-profile smash-and-grab robberies made headlines, some politicians blame Prop 47 for creating a perception that these crimes have no consequences. Property crime rates were at historic lows in 2020, down 30% since 2000. Robberies decreased by 14% and rapes decreased by 8%. What do those statistics mean? How can we put them in context here? Magnus, you want to start with that?
Sure. And I kind of alluded to this before in my opening remarks. And that is that there is a considerable research body now on the impacts of Prop 47 on crime. And so far, there's none that is linking Prop 47 to any increases in violent crime. As I said, we did find evidence that in the wake of Prop 47, that larcenies went up. And as I mentioned, that was particularly driven by an increase in car break-ins. But kind of coming back to Greg's point here about shoplifting, retail theft, one of the things that we did observe in the data was in the immediate wake of Prop 47, shoplifting went up very notably. We saw that in that first year of Prop 47, we saw an increase in shoplifting. So the crime statistics were able to pick up on that and suggested that there was some impact on Prop 47 on shoplifting. But importantly, what we saw then in 2016 and subsequent years was that shoplifting, the reported number of shoplifting incidents, came back down to the levels that we had before Prop 47. Whether this is really representing then a decrease from 2015 or a combination of a real decrease or a decrease in reporting is impossible to really say. You know, unfortunately, we haven't seen the retail industry provide data and statistics that allows for a comparison over time that would maybe give us a better insight to the possible impact on shoplifting. But like I said, we did see an impact from that perspective of an increase in 2015. It started pretty soon after Prop 47 was passed in November. But by 2016, it was back to where we were in 2014.
Greg, do you have any further observations?
Yeah, I think something we've long known in the criminal justice arena when it comes to victim behavior is that when victims feel that there is nothing positive that's going to come from their reporting a crime, we see this in domestic violence, we see it in sexual assault, we see it in property crimes, with the elderly, with the frauds that Jennifer mentioned earlier, we also see it in retail theft. If you're a business and you see a retail theft and you have an employee that sees a retail theft and reports it, that employee is going to be taken out of service for between 3 and 4 hours by the time law enforcement comes and responds, if law enforcement comes and responds at all. And it's going to have an impact upon your ability to conduct your normal business. And so many businesses, we think, are making financial decisions, economic decisions, risk management decisions to avoid reporting it because it's just too costly for them because they know nothing's going to happen. And what used to be treated as a felony, where you've got a career criminal going into a store and preying upon that store, where the individual is arrested and brought to court on the charge, now is a simple ticket. It's almost akin to a speeding ticket, even though it's not an infraction, it's a misdemeanor, and many of those people never show up in court. So I think this issue of underreporting is a significant one, and it is one that is very difficult from a statistical standpoint to get our arms around. It's really hard to say what exactly it equates to.
There are recent polls. Excuse me, go ahead. Did you have something to add, Greg?
No.
As far as Prop 47 is concerned, I mean, there are some misconceptions, but there and media coverage, again, factors into this. But recent polls indicate that there's broad support across the board, and it's not on a partisan basis particularly, for changes in Prop 47. Can you speak to any specific changes that you think need to be made? Any of you have any thoughts on that?
Did you want me to speak to that? I'd be happy to. I think what Prop 47 did is it took a whole class of crime, both drug crimes and property crimes that were historically could have felony consequences, and it converted them into misdemeanors. With regard to property crimes in particular, and I think that's what's driving the LA Times poll that you referenced and public opinion in general and the concern in general. Historically, if we had someone who had been in and out of prison, had a prior record of criminal violence, and steals from a store, that person with qualifying priors could be charged as a felon. What Prop 47 did is all individuals now who commit that theft, unless it exceeds $950, which is rare, are treated as misdemeanors, regardless of their background. And the net effect of that is that there's a perception, a pretty accurate perception by many members of the criminal community, that there are no consequences for retail theft, so the problem is escalating.
This would lead us to a discussion of the obvious related issue here, which is incarceration. It's a statistical reality that California incarcerates far more people than other developed countries. Mm-hmm. With a massive state correctional budget, high recidivism rates, and limited rehabilitation or post-release services, many critics point out that more public funds are spent on prisons and jails than on schools, and far too little on prevention, early intervention, rehabilitation, or the root causes of crime, such as poverty, homelessness, family dysfunction, domestic violence, untreated mental illness, racism. Poor people and people of color, mainly Black men and boys, are incarcerated at levels far disproportionate to their numbers in the population. How do you think these factors affect and define crime statistics in California? And how can this be addressed? Magnus, you've done a lot of research on prisons and prison populations and racial disparities and inequality, and perhaps Jennifer and Gregory and Allison, you have some other thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a few things here on this topic. The first one is that the U.S. Nationwide has a very high incarceration rate, one of the highest in the world. That's absolutely true. But California's incarceration rate is below the national average. I think that's well worth pointing out. And not only that, I think that we did certainly incarcerate to a very large extent, to such a great extent that we had severe prison overcrowding, lawsuits, federal courts intervening and telling the state that you have to reduce your overcrowding, your prison population due to overcrowding that prevented the state from providing adequate health and mental health care to its inmate population. That was really the what started these reforms that we've seen in California with realignment. Mm-hmm. And if we look at from the peak of California's incarcerated population, both the jails and prisons, that was around 2007, 2008, we had about 250,000 people incarcerated in our jails and prisons. With the reforms, as well as COVID also reduced our prison and our jail populations. We're down to about 150,000 now. That is a very dramatic decrease in our incarcerated population. As I said, part of that is due to the reforms. COVID has also contributed. But what we saw, realignment in particular, what we were looking at there was really the possibility of figuring out what is the incapacitation effect of incarceration. So keeping someone off the street, what kind of crimes are you preventing by doing that, and to what extent are you doing that? And when we looked at realignment back in 2011, 2012, the only crime that incarceration seemed to prevent at that point at that level was auto theft. And about, we estimated at that time that for that marginal prisoner who was no longer incarcerated as a result of realignment, you had an increase of about 1.2 auto thefts per year. You do a cost benefit analysis of that. You realize that incarceration at those levels really doesn't give you a lot in terms of crime prevention. And we brought up this clear indication that we should look for alternatives. We brought up the policing being one of those, that policing is certainly increased policing levels is something that the research body consistently finds reduces crime. But there are obviously other alternatives as well. And we have pursued some of those here in California. We have also looked at the possibility that the reforms has reduced racial disparity, one of the big problems within our criminal justice system. And we definitely found that in terms of arrests and bookings, that Prop 47 led to decreases in racial disparity in arrests and bookings. And more broadly, if we looked over that period, a 10-year period of reforms, we also found that it notably decreased racial disparity, especially differences between Black and white individuals in California in terms of incarceration. So we've seen impacts there as well.
Any other thoughts in this area before we move on to...
Well, the one thing I would like to talk about just briefly is misdemeanor. So there's not really good statistics on how many misdemeanor cases are filed nationwide, but it is roughly 13 million. That is about 80% of our criminal dockets. And shout out here to Harvard professor Alexandra Nadipov, who does the research on this and does an excellent job. But that's a huge part of the criminal justice system that largely goes unseen by the public. Nobody's out covering misdemeanor courts for their newspaper. There's not the staff to do that, and there's not the interest in it. But those are not consequence-free charges, criminal charges. They can have long-ranging effects on people, even though they're not felonies. And they can be really serious crimes like domestic violence and drunk driving, but they can also be things like loitering and jaywalking. And there's just this huge number of people who are in that criminal justice system who have effects that last decades, fines that they cannot pay off, loss of jobs, housing, government aid, that there is a deterrent value to those misdemeanors, but there's also a punishment value to them that we really don't recognize. And that is something I would really love to see additional coverage of. And I would love to see some additional coverage of the decrease in racial disparity that Magnus just talked about. I was not aware of that, and that is fascinating, and I would love to know more about that.
The issue of misdemeanors, whether to charge as a misdemeanor or a felony, many misdemeanors, people who can't afford bail, staying in jail. You want to speak a little bit more to the no bail issues? I know that's been a big, big issue and maybe contributing to some of the statistics. Gregory or Allison, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, as to the bail issue, I mean, speaking from my experience in Ventura County, when I was a young prosecutor, it was not uncommon for misdemeanants to serve lengthy jail sentences, to stack up multiple cases that would be sentenced on a consecutive basis. Today, that process, that practice is largely over. Most of your defendants, at least most of the defendants we had that were in custody, were pending felony charges, and some were sentenced inmates. Realignment took another whole class of offenders that would have historically gone to state prison that are felons and required them to be sentenced to local jails as a prison sentence rather than go to a state institution. Just to add a little measure, misdemeanors definitely have consequences, and I would never want to discount that. But again, getting back to Prop 47 and the issue of retail theft, the promise of Prop 47 was treatment, not jail. The promise was we're going to get these people into treatment. And I think, from a prosecutor's perspective, we don't want to incarcerate people that have mental health, substance abuse issues, things of that sort. We want them to get help. We think it serves the community overall safety and the best interest of the community to do that. But what Prop 47 did is it changed the traditional carrot and stick approach we had for retail theft, where you have a potential felony case hanging over someone's head, motivating them to go into treatment. With Prop 47 now, where they get a ticket, many never show up for the court. And for those that do, even when they're invited into treatment, resist it because the consequences for the misdemeanor case are generally a night or two at most in jail, and there's no supervision. Why would they ever want to enroll in a drug treatment program, an 18-month drug treatment program, when they can be back out on the streets within a day or two? And so what we have seen, what our colleagues are reporting to us, is there's as much of an 80% decline in drug treatment enrollment, drug court enrollment, and other diversion types of programs for substance abusers, for people with mental health issues, because there's no consequences. So it's axiomatic that to motivate somebody into treatment, you need to have both a carrot and stick approach. And Prop 47, while it may have done many good things, it removed that stick, and there are people, it borders on the inhumane, with people that are increasingly homeless, cycling in and out of the system with no treatment. And we need to fix that.
Yeah, that's, jails and prisons are often called the new asylums because of the Lannerman Petras Short 50 some years ago.
Right.
Created the system of 5150s and mental health holds, and it was a reaction to terrible conditions in the state hospitals where people had no rights and often were there, kept there for long periods of time. So the situation now, and this is an issue I've covered for decades, starting at the Sacramento Bee when I covered conditions in the state hospitals, but now we have the straight line result on the streets, with police essentially being frontline responders. There will be other panels subsequent to this one dealing with solutions and with changing the way law enforcement responds to mental health calls. But how can the criminal justice system respond currently? We have a lot of people who are in jail awaiting mental health evaluations, who, you know, haven't been convicted, haven't even been tried, because there's a huge backlog. And then there are, you mentioned some of the diversion programs and people being reluctant to go into those. I mean, I know the solutions here are intractable and that the subsequent panels will be dealing with that. But on a statistical basis, a very large percentage, as you mentioned, Greg, are people who are mentally ill with substance abuse issues. If they're released, they're going to be back on the streets. They're going to be back into emergency rooms. You know, do the systems need to be more coordinated? And that's a long-winded response. I'd like to have a general discussion on that, if anyone would like to start it.
Yeah, I'm kind of building on what you were saying, Sigurd, as well as what Greg was talking about. You know, the intentions of Prop 47 shifting us towards more treatment and programming, and I think that's where there's real room for improvement. And then that is the evaluation of what has been done at the local level to try to identify what has worked and what hasn't worked. I don't think we're in a place where we can speak on a broad sense of what those impacts are. And that's kind of like there's a real opportunity for us there to actually dig deeper and try to assess that better, to see to what extent there's led to improvement and where it hasn't led to improvement. So I think that's certainly an area and of room for improvement, as I said, but also an opportunity. But I also think it's interesting when we talk about Prop 47 and retail theft. You know, all the issues we brought up, many issues, including the reporting part. But I also think it's when we look at what is driving our discussions around this right now, the headliners are about smash and grab. And I think, you know, it raises that possibility of, well, are they really, these are not necessarily, depending on the circumstances, shoplifting incidents. They can be charged quite differently depending, again, on their circumstances. Anywhere from robbery to organized retail theft to commercial burglary, all carrying that possibility of charging them as a felony as well, and moves it out of that space of talking about Prop 47. So I think that's kind of interesting. Those are the ones that are driving our discussions. They are, to a large extent, seemingly not shoplifting incidents, at least the ones that I've read about.
Any other thoughts here?
Magnus is right on that. The crimes that we're seeing often rise to the level of more serious offenses. If you can apprehend the individuals, we can potentially charge them with more serious offenses than retail theft. Getting back to the mental health issue, it's, you know, again, from a criminal justice standpoint, we're trying to deal with it. I mean, many law enforcement agencies now have crisis intervention teams, and they have all of their peace officers trained in crisis intervention techniques rather than the traditional take control mindset of a peace officer. They need to slow things down. And so those kinds of trainings are having a positive impact on the street and reducing the incidence of shooting of mentally ill, which is a very good thing. In the court system itself, many of our jails now are operating mental health wings with trained experts to assist those people, make sure they get their appropriate medications, and where possible, get them into mental health beds rather than traditional jail beds. That's a significant issue that we've got at the local level, is not having enough bed space, not having enough mental health bed space. I would say that is, from my perspective, perhaps more of a significant issue than the grave disability definition and concerns that's too rigorous. And then another thing we're doing in the criminal justice system is mental health courts. You know, we see cases, a common type of case involving somebody who's mentally ill may be a threat. very serious threat. But how the criminal justice system deals with that if the person is mentally ill is altogether and must be altogether different than, say, how it would deal with a husband who makes a very serious threat and is stalking his spouse. We have to recognize, we have to delineate those cases and deal with them differently. So mental health courts are equipped with experts. They're equipped with programs that we can put those people into that don't involve the traditional criminal justice incarceration responses. Right. And, you know, that is, I think, an area that holds great promise for the future.
There also is Laura's Law on the civil side, which is now more widely adopted in California since the law was strengthened. It's been around for 20 years, but and that's on the civil side to before someone is arrested, trying to get them into treatment and supervised by a civil court judge. One of the areas here, and Allison, if you could comment on this or if you have statistics on this, is the lack of data on the number of people who are mentally ill, who are going to prisons and jails, and also, you know, follow-up statistics. Is that anything that the Department of Justice is able to track or follow?
It's really not. We do get some reporting from state hospitals of crimes reported within state hospitals, but not anything in terms of population management, who's coming in, who's going out, and the volumes that they're seeing based on, you know, what's happening in the population. Well, I think probably the Department of Corrections or state hospitals would probably have those statistics available, but that's not something that the department tracks.
Right. Well, one of the big issues in mental health reporting that I've reported on is the lack of data, the lack of coordination among agencies. I mean, the state hospitals now incarcerate primarily people who have been determined as criminally insane by the courts, but they're also tasked with doing evaluations of people who have been charged with crimes who are staying in jail. But that, you know, that's an issue that perhaps can be dealt with in subsequent panels. Let's turn back to some of the numbers here. Domestic violence was a big issue in the crime reports. One statistics that jumped out at me that was highlighted in the Attorney General's press release was a 42% increase from 2019 to 2020 in, quote, domestic violence related calls for assistance involving a firearm. Of course, this is exacerbated. Domestic violence cases are exacerbated by the pandemic, isolation, as are mental health issues. And those are only the cases, again, that are reported. There's huge under-reporting in domestic violence cases, as in rape cases. And all of us are very familiar with the case in Sacramento currently of the man who killed his three children and then himself in a supervised visit as a result of he was facing a restraining order, but he was still able to get a gun. And it was an assault rifle, illegal weapon. Can we have a conversation here on the domestic violence statistics and the role of the courts, particularly in terms of restraining orders addressing this issue? I mean, it's a statistical issue, but it's, you know, very much a human issue. Anyone want to start on that one? These are all difficult questions. Magnus?
It's a truly important issue, and some of the numbers that we're hearing are very much troubling. We have not really examined domestic violence situations very closely at PPIC. We had discussions about doing that, especially as the pandemic started, recognizing the challenges that individuals, families were facing with things like shelter in place and all the uncertainty and the turmoil that we were all experiencing, but ultimately did not pursue that. And it came back to this concern about reporting. and the serious underreporting that is likely to be the case for domestic violence. And our concern was that we might actually be dealing with a situation where the underreporting increased as a result of the pandemic. Thinking about the, you know, especially the shelter in place order and the kind of environment that you're in there, that you are now in a place with your spouse that might actually present the real problem to reach out and report the situation as it's happening. So it isn't something that we have yet studied very closely at all, unfortunately.
The man who killed his children and then himself and also killed a chaperone who was supervising the, or, you know, present for the court-ordered visitation with the children, did not have a previous criminal record until about 5 days before the murders, when he was arrested in Merced County for, I think it was a DUI, assaulting a police officer, resisting arrest, was released the following day. He made bail, apparently. And there was, you know, the lack of follow-up on whether or not a person under a restraining order has a gun is very complicated. But also, Gregory, if you could comment a little bit about how that might have been prevented had the agencies been perhaps communicating better, you know, if Merced County had known about the restraining order.
Yeah.
Merced County
we're still learning the details of exactly what did and did not occur. But from my limited knowledge of the case, and I'm like you, I only know what I've read in the newspaper and seen on TV, but from my limited knowledge of the case, it kind of presents a classic intimate partner violence scenario, in that it's escalating, his conduct's escalating. He's obviously got anger management issues. And we try to get restraining orders. We get emergency protective orders. We actually, you know, many DA's offices have clinics for the victims so that we can walk them through the process of getting restraining orders. We even have 911, you know, cell phones that we give them so that they can call on a moment's notice if they're at risk. With the pandemic, as Magnus pointed out, many of those problems in the home were exacerbated. If they were having financial difficulties, it's exacerbated when everybody's in the home, and the stress of having everybody in the home contributed to what we think is a significant increase in domestic violence. But if you've got someone who is determined to stalk and do physical harm to his intimate partner, about the only way of preventing that, short of, you know, a 24-hour surveillance, is to have them in custody. What the what was known about him at the time of the arrest in Merced, we're still learning. It's not uncommon to have somebody be released under the circumstances of that offense, even though they've got a restraining order in those situations. But I think it speaks to a much more significant issue, and that is that the epidemic, and it is an epidemic of domestic violence, has a profound impact upon us from a societal standpoint and from a criminal justice standpoint. If a person grows up in a home where he is exposed to violence, he is exposed to domestic violence, 76% of those people will become abusers themselves. Individuals who grow up in violent homes are much more likely to become substance abusers. They're much more likely to commit crimes as juveniles. They're much more likely to engage in dangerous and reckless behavior that increases health risk and a myriad of other things. A study was done by Kaiser Permanente back in the 1990s that involved 17,000 people. It was a longitudinal study. And the results of that study is called the Adverse Childhood Experiences.
Right.
And children who have scored a certain level on that analysis are at much greater risk. And from a criminal justice standpoint, if we want to impact crime, we need to start in the home. We need to impact those families to reduce the incidence of violence in the home. I think that, frankly, is the area that holds the greatest promise for reducing crime overall.
Right. Thank you. We have a few questions here. One of the questions, is there data, and Allison, if you have a response to this, is there data about the impact of the opioid and meth crisis on criminal activity? That's a pretty broad question. Is there anything in the statistics on that, Allison?
We don't have anything specific to that. Due to the way statutes are written and the way crime is reported under those definitions I previously mentioned, we don't have specifics on how opioid and meth is reported to us. However, there may be others on the panel who have done studies or are aware of studies on how that has impacted activity.
Any of you have thoughts on that?
No, I don't know. I think it's one of the challenges is data on drug use in general. That's very challenging, and that's really what you need in order to assess then if it has any impact on criminal activity. So it's challenging. It is likely there is an increase in drug use. There is little doubt about it. There being a big problem in our society as well. So, it is very likely that it's going to have some impacts on crime as well. So this is not a very well understood issue, but it certainly deserves more attention.
And I'd just like to add, I completely agree that we need to be studying this. And I think one way that we might want to do that is to look at the treatment that people who are incarcerated are getting. It does feel when you're a defense attorney that that is often a myth that your client is going to actually get treatment, because it can be really hard to get into those programs because they are limited. And people get pulled out of them for behavior problems or for other issues just because of what their condition or what their conviction was. So, but maybe expanding those and then being able, we would be able to know who's being treated for what.
We also have a question here. California instituted determinate sentencing in 1976, I covered it, and three strikes in 1994. What is the data on the effects of these laws? Allison, is there any data that you can speak to, or Gregory, anyone? Those were important determinants.
There isn't anything specific that I can speak to on this.
On three strikes, there were a number of reports issued in the years following the implementation of three strikes that reported a marked decline in violent crime in the state of California and overall crime. I think violent crime went down somewhere in the neighborhood of 40%. Overall crime went down 33%. Now, those reports linked those declines to the initiative, to the three strikes initiative. I think probably somebody of Magnus's sophistication might question some of those linkages, but that's what was reported. And I can tell you from a prosecutor's perspective, we thought those laws helped us with career criminals, with people who really presented a danger. Were there abuses with the way those laws were implemented in some jurisdictions that were too heavy-handed? Yes, there were a number of examples that I think we can all that come to mind, but I think largely they have had they've given us the ability to take the most dangerous, prolific offenders out of society, and there are individuals, there are predators out there that should not be in our communities, and three strikes enabled us to go after them.
There's a lot of pressure now to change three strikes, mm-hmm. That it has disproportionately affected people of color and that it's been utilized in a heavy-handed fashion, you know, having extremely long sentences when the third strike might be a fairly minor crime. Jennifer, as a former criminal defense attorney, what is your view of three strikes?
While I agree that when used against some of the worst, it can have that incapacitation effect and prevent violent crime, these aren't always limited to the worst of the worst. And when you have a broad statute that says, you know, three strikes and you're out, that doesn't necessarily catch, you know, only the upper tier of criminal behavior. And it can sweep in a lot of other people. So it is a thorny issue. It has to, you know, I think it's something that should be more nuanced.
There's one question here specifically to Gregory. Have pretrial settlements in criminal cases increased or decreased as a result of the pandemic, or have they not been affected?
I don't have statewide data, but I can tell you our experience in Ventura County is they increased. With all of the courts coming out of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice to delay cases and deal with the pandemic in a way that kept people safe within the criminal justice system from the spread of this virus. Many cases, you know, there's been concerted efforts to resolve cases as soon as practical and possible. I think one of the concerns we have going forward is the backlog of cases, notwithstanding those efforts to resolve cases, the backlog of those cases has grown exponentially, and there's going to come a point of reckoning where when the courts truly open up fully, and, you know, we're going to have a backlog of trials that we're going to have to deal with, and many jurisdictions are going to truly struggle with handling those cases within the statutory timeframes required by law.
We have a question here, and we just have a couple minutes left. Are COVID population controls in county jails going to end? I mean, I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, or you spoke to it briefly, Gregory. People in jails and prisons, inmates have died. There's been some resistance among correctional officers, according to various news articles, to being vaccinated. So are the COVID population controls in county jails likely to end with the winding down of the pandemic more to an endemic? Any thoughts on that?
I'm not sure I'm qualified. I really need to talk to a sheriff or a CDCR official to know. I mean, I can tell you again, in Ventura County, the COVID practices were very robust and really designed towards keeping the inmate population as safe as possible.
Okay. Well, this is a thorny topic, as we said from the beginning. I'd like, if there are any final brief thoughts on what statistics mean, what statistics we should be collecting and are not collecting, cooperation among agencies. Magnus, do you have any thoughts there?
Well, I think there is one topic that we haven't really touched upon. We have mentioned the increase in homicides. It is very notable. What we observed in California was an increase of 500 homicides in 2020. And while the homicide rate is low, especially compared to the early 1990s, that one-year jump is the biggest we have ever seen in California since we started to collect these kind of numbers in 1960. And what it points towards is that the people who died were to the vast majority were men of color, mm-hmm. and it was gun-related as well. That's where we saw the biggest uptick. It was in gun-related deaths that took place on our streets and in public spaces as well. So I think that is, as we move forward, that's an issue here to kind of better understand. It is the top of my list of concerns that I have regarding crime in California is exactly this. There are some violent crime homicides. There's some increases in aggravated assaults, also gun-related, that deserves our attention to better understand. They're having, again, very disparate impacts. It is on communities of colors.
And this case, the Sacramento case, I hate to keep going back to it, but it's a classic example of someone getting a gun easily when there was a court order preventing him ostensibly from doing that. And I don't, you know, clearly there need to be, that needs to be addressed, and it certainly needs to be studied. Any final thoughts, Jennifer?
I'll just say that I was very heartened to hear President Biden address in the State of the Union that he was going to be appointing somebody to be a special prosecutor or to, you know, focus on pandemic fraud. And I think that's an area that California should be interested in. With the unemployment fraud that happened in our system, anytime you have a large pot of money, there's going to be a lot of fraud going on. So I will be watching that really carefully in the future and hoping that unlike after the housing market crash, that the investigation isn't just going after the low-hanging fruit, but is going to be targeting the people who organized that fraud.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here. I really appreciate all your time and your considerable expertise. And I hope, you know, we'll be discussing some of the solutions as the conference continues. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Capital Weekly podcast is produced by Tim Foster for Open California. If you enjoyed today's episode, we hope you'll go onto iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a positive review. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.